Sustainable investing is a choice, but does that choice have to come at the expense of sound investment principles? Is investing with a purpose possible? Can sustainable investing help to reduce our carbon footprint? That's some of what we'll be talking about this next hour, so stay with us. Welcome, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We thank you for listening and for being a part of our world. A big shout-out and thanks to the sponsor of this show, Pathways Financial Partners. Their tagline is, "Today, Tomorrow, Together." And I can tell you from personal experience, they mean it. Founded in 1998, Pathways Financial Partners is an independent, fee-only investment advisor serving successful individuals and retirement plan sponsors. Their evidence-based investment philosophy and high-touch client service create positive and enduring solutions for their clients, and we're proud to have them as one of our newest partners. Their newest endeavor, which thrills me beyond measure, is their web-based offering, sustainableinvestingonline.com, serving sustainable-minded investors who want to reduce their carbon footprint while investing in their future. And of course, I'm thrilled about that. As you all know, educating people in intentional and impactful ways about the clear and present danger of climate change and its impact on our health and the health of the planet is what drives me and everyone on the Mrs. Green's World team. Let's be honest, we know stuff. So needless to say, we are all very excited and interested in this show today because it's a first for us in terms of content and because it is an area that has great impact on the planet. Sustainable investing. Is it even possible? With me in studio for this next hour is such a perfect candidate for being able to answer the many questions I have, and I believe that many of us have about sustainable investing. Please join me in welcoming Reuben Miller, Regional Director for Dimensional Fund Advisors, or DFA, as we shall be referring to it, because that's a long Dimensional Fund Advisors. They are a global investment manager dedicated to implementing the great ideas in finance. Founded in 1981, they have a long history of applying academic research to practical investing. They offer a full range of equity and fixed income strategies designed to target higher expected returns, and who doesn't like that? So, Reuben, thank you so much for being here. And let's start off with the obvious. It's what is DFA? What is Dimensional Fund Advisors?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be here in Tucson. It's not cold, but just great to be on the show.
It is not cold. Let us press pause on that. It's in the hundreds already.
So Dimensional Fund Advisors is what we call a mutual fund company. So we create investment solutions. You can think of it as diversified portfolios for clients. And there's a lot of ways to invest, obviously. So if you think about what a mutual fund company does, is a mutual fund is just a vehicle. And it contains many securities all kind of wrapped up. And so there's some economies of scale that a company can deliver to clients by doing that. If someone wanted to go out, Gina, if you wanted to go, you know, build yourself a diversified portfolio on E-Trade or ScottTrade.com, it's very difficult to implement that. You got to go buy kind of a bunch of stocks on your own, and each one has a transaction cost. So at mutual fund companies, which have been around for a long time, they just kind of take those economies of scale for clients. And so the fees are a little bit lower. The implementation can be a little bit more intentional the way we do that. So as you said, we've been around since the early 80s, kind of formed out of the University of Chicago and research there around what drives stock and bond returns through time. There was an interesting kind of confluence of things that happened back in the late 70s and early 80s. You know, the traditional way things were always done is that if somebody wanted someone to pick stocks on their behalf or create an investment experience, they would pay someone, an advisor or a broker, and that person would pick their favorite stocks or bonds and build a portfolio, and then, you know, hopefully they would, quote unquote, beat the market. But for many years, there was really no no proxy for what the market was, or people didn't really know what that was, and it certainly was an investable vehicle. In the late 70s and 80s, with the advent of a lot of computing power, people could then go back and actually see how the market had done, say a diversified group of stocks, what we call an index or a benchmark, and then what you had done or what your advisor had done on your behalf. Well, it turns out that over long periods of time, people that are trying to pick stocks and that are charging fees for that privilege on behalf of clients, in aggregate, you know, most of them don't beat the market, if you will. We can get into a little bit about what the market would be or the relevant benchmark. So dimensional, or as you said, an evidence-based approach is we look at that kind of research and we say, well, it turns out it's really hard to beat the market. And so why not just kind of leverage that and try to create great investment experiences around it, kind of use the information in stock prices as opposed to going out there every day trying to outguess everyone else. So that's the first thing I would say. And most people would kind of align what I'm describing with as a passive investment approach. So that's the one thing I'd maybe start with about dimensional is we take a passive philosophy, is we think markets work pretty well. You know, and that there's information in prices about what types of companies you might be buying. But we don't go out there every day trying to outguess everyone else, saying that stock's too low or that stock's too high. You got to sell bonds. You got to buy stocks. We're not that kind of company. And so the second part I would say is we're also not an index fund. And most people sometimes think those two words, passive and indexing, are synonymous. An index fund, and indexes are pretty good. We're fans of that approach. But what an index fund does, and the most common or most frequently known one is probably the S&P 500 or maybe the Dow Jones. Right. Well, an index fund, you have a company like Standard & Poor's, S&P, and they get together, most indices once or twice a year, and they create a list. And what's nice about having a group create a list is it's going to be super transparent. As a consumer, you're going to know exactly what you get if you pay someone to track that list for you. The S&P 500 is 500 of the largest U.S. stocks. And so then an index provider will commercialize that list from Standard & Poor's. And then they create an investable vehicle that you can go actually invest in. And so then you would own the S&P 500. And because there's no analysts involved and there's no really research about the specific companies done, it's just a data cut on 500 large companies, you can imagine you get a pretty low cost from them for providing that fund to you. So all of a sudden, what I've described is 500 stocks. That's pretty diversified. You get a low cost because there's no analysts running out and doing all this complex research. And you get transparency because you know all 500 stocks. So all things that Dimensional is big fans of. When we were started, we just kind of are of the feeling that, you know, just tracking some list might not be the most intentional or thoughtful way to approach the capital markets. So we kind of create our own internal list. So we're very much like an index provider, except we kind of do our own list and do some other things around the edges. So in that sense, we're passive, kind of with an active implementation.
So when you talk about the S&P 500 and the top 500 companies being the largest, is that just on revenue, gross revenue?
So that's actually market capitalization. And okay. The way you do that is open up your little phone, go to the stock ticker,
right,
and you can see that, you know, any company, Apple, Yahoo, Chipotle, Buffalo Wild Wings, whatever you want to name, everything has a price. Now, what would not be the right way to do it is open that and say, well, that company is at 120 and the other company is at 160. So that 160 is more expensive. The reason why that wouldn't be the best way to think about it is that that's price per share. So what really matters is what's the price on the stock ticker, the app that we can all open, multiplied by how many shares are there in the world. How many shares outstanding is the terminology we use. So take shares outstanding, which you could find easily with just a Google search.
Got it.
Chipotle shares outstanding multiplied by stock ticker, price for the per stock, per share. And that is the value of a company.
So their market cap.
Exactly. That's
okay.
The market cap.
Okay. So even what you talked about so far, Ruben, is like, I actually think I'm pretty smart. But this is an area that to me is just... it's so massive, and for the consumer to try and wrap our heads around it, even for us wanting to do the right things, just from what you said so far, it's like, it's a big deal. So, which leads me to my next question. If you care about the planet like I do, it's what gets me up in the morning, it's what motivates my team, we want to do the right thing, the good thing, as we say in a lot of our writing. So there are so many technical terms out there. There's SRI, and then there's ESG, and then there's sustainable investing, and then there's impacted investing. Mm-hmm. It's a really, to me, a crowded and somewhat complicated, very complicated, not somewhat, space. Can you kind of go through some of those and share with me, like, start with impact investing. What is that? We'll go through one at a time, because when I was doing a lot of research for this show, it makes your head spin if you're not living it every day.
I think even stepping away from just the Mrs. Green's world approach, kind of the environmental scope that we have today, investing in general is very
overwhelming.
Confusing.
Overwhelming.
And in some ways, you can imagine that the industry for many years is, and maybe to some point now, incentivized to keep it that way. Right? So
yes.
Money, we get such a visceral reaction to thinking about money and investing. And a lot of people, myself included many times, just kind of, I just don't want to deal about it or think about it. And so just for starters, even before we get to the sustainability kind of conversation or environmental scope, in general, just money and investing is tough to talk about, and it kind of gives us chills a little bit. And I think that in general, that's benefited the investing industry, right? If people don't want to think about it or care about it, you just kind of say, okay, just go do it for me. Well, in general, you're probably going to pay a higher fee than if you had asked all the right questions, right? So that's maybe a good place to start. Let's dive into your explicit questions. Impact investing, sustainable investing, ESG, SRI, what are all these things? So impact investing, and I think that's probably going to take a little bit of a backseat in our conversation today. Impact investing tends to refer to private placement investing.
Got it.
So think about, let's say there's just this remarkable story. There's a rice farm in Africa. And you also, let's say you're a potential investor who really cares about female empowerment. They happen to hire widows to help tee the farm. And there's just all these great stories that really resonate with your personal belief system. It's just something you would love to be an investor in, to support and get
Got
behind,
it.
Tell all your friends about. Well, so that's impact investing. And the reason why is because that's not a publicly traded company. And publicly traded companies are the ones you can pull up on the stock ticker app. The
right.
rice farm in
right.
Africa is not. So what does that look like? Impact investing, you could give your capital to them. Maybe they offer you to own some equity in the company. So you could give them $10,000 and own some percentage of the rice farm. What you don't have when you do something like that is a lot of clarity around the investment outcome, whether over short periods of time or long periods of time. We don't know what's going to change in Africa.
It's a higher risk.
That's where I'm getting at.
Right,
exactly.
A much
For
higher
many
risk.
Reasons.
Yeah.
It's likely a higher risk than what we'll talk about today in diversified publicly traded stocks. But for many reasons, which is probably worth kind of elaborating on, we don't know what's going to happen just with the government in whatever country you're investing in. And if it's, you know, if it's a country that tends to be in emerging markets, we tend to think of those as maybe even more higher risk. You don't know about people's appetite for rice. You don't know if the person that runs that company and is the thought leader, if that person went away, is that company still going to be able to survive?
Right. And is quinoa going to be the next best thing for everybody to
yeah.
eat? Hurts the rice market. Let's have quinoa.
So for those reasons, you would call that a very undiversified portfolio, right? You own one company that produces rice. Despite that, that might be the perfect company to help you sleep at night. Right, it's everything you care
yes.
about.
Female yes.
empowerment, and it's doing well for the world, and it's giving people jobs who need them, and it's all these great things. So that's what we will talk a lot about today. That's the trade-offs, right? We're talking about an investment outcome or a desired investment outcome, and then how do I put my head on my pillow at night and feel like I'm standing by things that I really care about or places I want to allocate my capital toward. So with that investment experience, you give some money there. You don't have a great idea of the outcome. Now, you might say, in general, companies that produce rice, if I look at all of them, public and private, they make 9% a year. Let's throw out a random number. Okay, well, you don't own a diversified portfolio of rice companies. You own one small farm or part of one small farm in Africa. And as we kind of described, there's a lot of factors that could really hijack that investment experience and make it go to zero. Or make it go down and
like
not
drought,
get the 9%.
Flood.
Sure.
I mean, there are so many risks when you think of that. It's like even I would want to invest in that, but probably wouldn't.
Right.
I mean, seriously, that's the honest reflection. It's like, no, that's not sound. But there are impact investors with lots of money who are doing it for the social responsible reasons. But most of them can afford to put a couple of big investments out there and recover. But for the average investor, you really have to look at it because like you said, it's our future. It's our college education for our kids. It's our retirement. Okay, so what?
So Yes. So sorry. So that would be impact, because you said that might play a part in someone's portfolio. And you could also own a bunch of these private placement impact investing type initiatives.
Right.
And maybe you can have a little bit more clarity around the potential outcome because you are a little bit more diversified. If one went bunk, you know, you still own 29 others or whatever it might be. But we would argue that that gets more towards speculating. No matter how great the initiative you might feel that it is, right? And there's this great book written about Wall Street. It's an old book. It's from the 40s by Fred Schwed. And it's called Where Are the Customer's Yachts? And Where Are the Customer's Yachts?
I love it.
It's an anecdote, this great Wall Street story about a broker, you know, takes a client down to the harbor and, yeah, that's my boss's yacht, and my yacht's that little smaller one. That's my yacht, and then look at that mammoth yacht over there. That's the executive's yacht. And this client looks at me. He's like, "Well, where are the customers' yachts, right? Where's this?" Anyway, Schwed has this great quote in that book, and I might butcher this, but it says something like, "Speculation is an effort, probably unsuccessful, to turn a little bit of money into a lot. Investing is an effort, which should be successful, to prevent a lot of money from becoming a little." The second part of that quote, I would argue,
which is brilliant.
Yeah, it's great.
And which is brilliant.
Right?
1943, and it lives on.
Still resonates today. The one thing I always like to copy is the second part of that isn't necessarily, doesn't tell the whole story, because actually, you know, investing can turn a little bit of money into a lot if you have kind of the right approach and you take a systematic, long-term investor, you can do that. So in general, though, as you said, the message of that resonated in 1940. It resonates amazingly now. So I love that. So the investing whatever amount of money in the rice farm may be a speculation if it's just that. If it's part of a broader portfolio, it may be an investment. Let's move away from the impact investing, which you said is private, right? I don't know every day what the rice farm in Africa is worth.
Right.
I might sleep really well at night, but I can't open my phone and see what the price is. Maybe it's worth $1 million, maybe it's worth 200,000, maybe it's worth 5,000. I don't know, and I can't really know. They can give me some numbers maybe once a year or quarterly, whatever it is, about their revenue and how they're doing, but there's no market, right? There's no competitive, publicly traded market where people are buying and selling every day where the prices change like that.
Got it.
So let's move to the other areas where there is that. So that's private, and then we'll move to kind of publicly traded, and that's the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones and other indices,
right,
not only in the U.S., but globally. And that's where conversations, where I'll kind of get to around SRI and ESG and sustainable. Which one do you want to start with?
So I want to know ESG.
Yeah, sure.
It sounds like an additive to your food. Oh, that's MSG. But I mean, what's ESG? That's how far I get with this one.
Yeah. So that acronym stands for Environmental Social Governance. And these are all kind of three things that you can consider in an investment portfolio at a company like mine, if you're creating mutual funds or ETFs or something like that. So the environmental part, that's pretty self-explanatory. Does your either investment philosophy or any overlay you might have in the portfolio address environmental concerns, whatever they might be? The S is for social, and that is similar in the vein. It might be part of the investment philosophy. It might be an afterthought or an overlay, but social concerns as opposed to maybe environmental concerns. And again, no, you don't have to look farther than our country to know a lot of people have different opinions about what's right socially.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So that differs a lot too. Some people think being socially responsible is one way, and other people say that no way. That's not what I believe in. I believe the exact opposite, and that's social to me. So social funds can mean many different things as well. And then governance. Governance is really a big entity like mine. Dimensional is a $600 billion money manager.
Wow.
So
they have their eyes. A lot of balls. It's like, what? You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
It makes my head swim. We have to take a short break
great.
In about, well, maybe about a minute. And when we come back, the question, this is like so helpful. And not only that, you're speaking English, which is, you know what I mean? It's like financial terms can be confusing, and that's what shuts people down. But you're giving us answers that I'm sitting here and understanding, which will help me and all my listeners, because it's a very, like I said, it's a complex carbohydrate out there. But when we come back, what I'd like to know, is there a difference between SRI, socially responsible investing, and sustainable investing, because those terms are, you know, thrown around like crazy. We come back more with Ruben Miller from Dimensional Fund Advisors. Stay here with me. We're learning so much.
Please join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and SpeakUp Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. Joining me for this hour is Ruben Miller, Regional Director for Dimensional Fund Advisors, and a little bit more about Ruben. Before joining Dimensional, Ruben was a senior fixed income trader, which that's probably a whole nother show, at Breakwater Capital in Chicago, managing algorithmic and structured strategy implementation across the dimensional yield curve, which he probably had on his business card. I mean, it's like, what? I read that. I'm like, okay, got it. He has a bachelor's degree from Kenya College, where he was also an NCAA collegiate soccer player and an MBA from the University of Southern California. Go Trojans. Ruben also earned the National Chess Master title. I love it when I find things out like this. When he was 15, which certainly proves to me that he is a very good strategist and has been for a very long time. So, Ruben, I don't know if that's a logical conclusion, but it's great to have you here. And thank you for your thorough answers. And you reminded me during the break, we got to the E, we got to the S, but we didn't get to the G. So what's the G in the SG?
Well, thank you. And thanks for the nice description. The fact is, really, we have a head of governance at Dimensional who I'm sure would get on my case if I didn't get this one out. So the G...
We don't want that.
We
do not
want
that.
No. So governance is at a, like I said, at a mutual fund company or some entity that creates vehicles like that. You know, on behalf of many of the owners, you're going to be voting on proxy votes and things like that, because Dimensional, as a $600 billion company, might own many percentages of an outright company, right?
So, right.
Especially if it aligns kind of with the philosophy at Dimensional, I can say, you know, we tend to own a lot of small companies, small publicly traded companies. So we may own 3 or 4 or 5% of the outstanding shares of a small company. So for that, it's very important how we might vote on certain things with or against the board and things like that. So do you, as a large growing company, pay attention to governance, and maybe what is your approach? And so that's that part. So to give you a little bit of context on Dimensional and how many companies might think through this, you know, the E and the S, environmental and social, Dimensional has created portfolios that address these things specifically. Whereas the G is actually something we look at in every portfolio.
Right.
So there are trade-offs in the other ones. Like we said, not everybody thinks that this is socially correct or
that this is bad or this is good.
Right. Or maybe I don't want an environmental overlay in my investment experience.
Right.
Whatever. Governance... That permeates through every one of our investment portfolios. And by governance in general, I mean kind of our approach to what we think about matters in governance, the way we vote on things, hold shareholder, the board accountable. So in that respect, that's a part of all of our portfolios. And the E and the S, kind of we have specific portfolios where certain clients want that as a part of their investment experience. Your original question before the break was about SRI versus sustainability. This nomenclature, as we say, it's super confusing, right?
I mean, it makes my head spin, and I live this. I do this for a living, and I'm like, okay, there's this, and there's that, and there's this. So, and of course, then the bottom line is, which is the best one, which there probably isn't a simple answer to that either. So what is the difference between socially responsible and just sustainable? Is there a difference?
Right, so socially responsible, or SRI, That is kind of like the blanket term. That's the big cloud, and everything we're talking about is kind of underneath it.
Okay.
And socially responsible, if you think about what's underneath it that we're talking about, sustainability would be under there. And actually, some of the more socially aligned initiatives,
yes,
at least in the way Dimensional describes things, which isn't always exactly in line with the industry, but at least we can get on the same page here, that would also be under the big umbrella. So you got social responsible investing and a bunch of things underneath. And then one of those would actually be kind of social or caring about more socially aligned things, whether it's your religious beliefs or some other beliefs you might have. And then sustainability tends to focus on the environment. So that's kind of where we go. Fund companies like Dimensional might create an array of different types of funds to meet specific client needs. And so you might have a fund that focuses on the environment, and you might have one that really aligns with a certain religion, or you might do a modicum of things. But that's kind of this, the lay of the land, if you will.
Okay, and understandable. And I mean, I think of examples, and you probably can't comment because of governance in your field, which is so understandable. But I know in my world, companies like Hershey, where there's been a lot of talk in the investment community, putting pressure on them because of using, they don't make the cacao, but sourcing it from mm-hmm. socially just and responsible farmers and all of that. So you can see it in the world of the environmentalists very clearly when you want social justice. And even places like Eileen Fisher, clothing industry, mm-hmm. I've interviewed them, I've met with their director of sustainability. You know, social justice is a huge thing. It's becoming even more of a conversation than it was 10 years ago because people are caring. There's such transparency. How many people are in that factory? What are their rights and
right.
all that? So those are things that I want to know more about now because I want my money to be put in companies that are moving towards doing the right thing. Again, it's complicated. You can't just flip the switch.
Right.
And you have to move towards, you know, what I call socially just and environmentally sustainable. So
I love it. I feel remiss if I don't kind of get to one big part of Dimensional's philosophy. And so moving away from the environmental or
right,
the social
right.
part for a second, is one, I mean, the kind of the highlighted bold capital letters is we think that there's information in prices. And so we accept prices as a fair assessment of what the company is worth. You know, when you go to the cocktail party or your friends at church say something like, I got a stock tick for you.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
You got to do this. You got to get in now. Those are people who are stating that I know something the market doesn't know and prices aren't fair, right? This stock is mispriced or underpriced. That's why you got to buy it or you got to get out of the market. It's too expensive. So Dimensional thinks prices are fair. We just kind of accept that as a pillar of our investment philosophy. So to the story about Hershey's or the distribution of cacao and whatever it might be, to your point about that's where you want to reallocate or allocate your capital, that's great because that's going to help you sleep at night and that's important to you as
right,
an investor.
Right.
Can you find companies who do things that you like, right? What for you it might be who have sustainable initiatives in the way they source cacao and create an investment vehicle with higher expected returns than not doing that? In other words, is there a premium to be had by knowing that they don't have labor or they don't treat their labor force the
right.
way you like them
right.
to? And that's more difficult precisely because prices adjust when there's publicly known information. So if a company, and I don't want to pick on Hershey's because
right,
I don't
either,
know,
but
right?
I mean,
yeah.
it's a good example.
Yeah.
And it's an example about how complicated it is.
Right,
because
right,
they're
right.
not on the production end, they're on the purchasing end.
Correct. And, or I actually don't know, but I'll
yeah,
take your word for it.
Trust Mrs.
Right,
Green.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I've learned that quickly today. But what you need to know as an investor, if we look on the other spectrum of the sliding scale of investment returns and then sleeping well at night, well, prices adjust for these things. So if it's publicly known information that most people don't really like the way they're sourcing their cacao, it's likely that the price is going to be affected by that. So instead of being $10 a share when you open up your phone ticker,
right, right.
it's $8 a share.
Right.
Because the last month that information came out and the price has dropped. So when you think about it as an investment, it might not be a company you really like, but it actually says very little whether a company is good or bad about what it is as an investment opportunity. That's because price matters
so
much.
I so get it.
Yeah. And it's not always what people want to hear because
it
a lot
isn't,
of people.
But I so get it. It's another one of those, there's no silver bullet. It's not a simple answer.
It really isn't. And that's where you have to weigh as a consumer or a market participant, kind of what do I care about? And if you care about only owning companies who have perfect distribution lines or where they source their materials from, and they have within their office, they have perfect recycling initiatives, and everything is just to a T, you're going to end up with a very undiversified portfolio. And so while you may sleep better at night, on the other scale about what's my investment experience going to look like, I actually have very little to tell you. I don't have a lot of clarity about that. Because you might own a couple private placement, like the farm in Africa, and you might own 12 stocks that you really like. And you're kind of indifferent to the price you paid because you didn't care about that. You cared about what are their environmental initiatives at the company. So at Dimensional, where the way we think about this is, you know, we have very diversified portfolios. That's a pillar, again, or a foundational element of our investment philosophy. And they're low cost and they're diversified and they're tax efficient. When our client base a little over 10 years ago kind of came to us and they said, you know, we would really like to take everything you do now, but more towards the other end, sleep a little better at night, right? We want you to add something to do, just pay attention to the environmental element of it, say in our sustainability portfolios. So what we've done is we've taken these super diversified portfolios and then looked at some metrics. And the big one we use would be greenhouse gas emissions of corporations.
Right.
And
the
we can get to a little bit more about what we do.
The biggest one.
And in our scoring system, that's 85% of what we look at. And so in that, we then get a scoring system and we can either reward companies who score really well and overweight them a little bit in the portfolio. Maybe they were 1% and then they're 1%.
When you say overweight them, do you mean that buy more shares to put in someone's?
Yeah,
because
so let's
say, an industry term.
Yeah, sorry. So let's say we have a portfolio that has 1,000 stocks and we do a screening of all the carbon footprint of every company in the 1,000 stock portfolio. And this is just hypothetical. This isn't how Dimensional necessarily does it. We get a list and we say, you know, wow, that company is terrible for the environment. Let's get them out of there. Well, let's say that the only screen we're doing on is emissions.
Okay.
What do you think kind of companies we're going to get rid of?
Yeah, I think about some of the biggest ones there are. I mean, the first thing I thought of was like Exxon and Shell and, you know, some of the biggies, the easy targets.
Well,
and heavy manufacturing and transportation. I mean, the list goes on.
The list goes on. I would say most of the things that you named or the list you would create is going to really focus on one or two or three sectors, right? You said Shell and Exxon right away. Energy.
I did.
Right? Manufacturing. So what actually happens is you take this diversified portfolio. We gave an example of 1,000 stocks. If you get rid of the, 200 worst ones, you're not going to get rid of 20% of the portfolio in an equal weight. You're actually going to get rid of a lot of companies that do the same thing. Because what you did was you just sorted on one metric.
Right.
And certain industries are worse than other industries on that metric. And I think you nailed it. Energy and manufacturing, those are kind of the two big ones that come up. So that's the other thing you have to think about when a company like Dimensional creates a sustainability portfolio is, well, do I really just want to omit a whole sector? When I came to this interview this morning, I drove. So I can't go out there and say, you know, I'm perfect for the world. Look at my portfolio. I got no energy company. It's like, well, I drove, you know? And when I fly home, I'm going to take an Uber back to my house and I got a car at my house. So all these things, I do them in other parts of my life. The low-hanging fruit might be the investment portfolio to make that look really pristine. There's a lot of other things we can do. So I say this to say those are kind of the trade-offs a company like mine has to consider because we likely don't want to omit a whole sector. If you look just this year, and even just this morning, oil recently has done very well. And you can, if people don't pay attention to the market that much, you can just, a good proxy for that is just how much you're paying for gas when you go back to fill your tank, right? So you may feel it and not know it, but oil's gone up recently. Well, if you own a portfolio, let's say the portfolio we built a second ago, it was 1,000 stocks before, and then someone said, I want a sustainability overlay, and we got rid of a lot of energy and manufacturing. Well, if companies are making their profits from the price of oil, they probably have done very well the last few weeks, and you would have missed that return. So for better or for worse, those are just things we have to think about and create an investment experience when it's a sliding scale from optimal outcome from an investment perspective and then that sleep well at night part. So that's some of the stuff that we think about. And the way we create a portfolios, just as a quick aside, is we look at both. We look at the most egregious offenders across the whole opportunity set. In the U.S., it's about 3,000 stocks. And in our international sustainability portfolios, it's about 5,000. And we also have an emerging market sustainability portfolio. So you have these opportunity sets of thousands and thousands of stocks. We look not only at, as I said, the most egregious offenders across the board, but then we try to maintain some diversification and still have exposure to sectors that maybe don't always score so well in those metrics, but there might be energy companies who actually have great initiatives and are much better for the environment relative to their peers. And because I'm someone that drove here and I'll drive when I get home and I have a car at home, all those things, who am I to say that those companies are bad just because they're in a sector?
Because you just don't ride a bike, live in a yurt, and have a composting toilet. I'm assuming that. I can't make assumptions, but it is a very, very important conversation to have, because I get that when it comes to partnering with one of our biggest utility company here. And they are a sponsor, they are great partners, and I get into it with people when I say, I live in a house where when it's 103, I want my air conditioning on, I want it cool, and I really don't stop to think where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. This house can't put solar on it because of the structural issues. So there is that piece where you feel somewhat like an environmental hypocrite, even though you're trying to move it forward. So to me, what you said in processing all of that is, it comes down to the consumer to be conscious and to keep advocating for things like renewable energy, which is a very healthy, robust, and good return on investment sector. Green jobs are growing consistently. And those are some numbers I watch. So it's really looking in terms of your own sustainable life, and then making changes around that. I do not ride a bike downtown either. I just want to go on record as saying that.
There's a great Voltaire quote, you know, that don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And that's how
I
think about.
Love your quotes.
That's how I think about at least the way I would want to build a sustainability portfolio. It just so happens that Dimensional does the same thing. And so maybe I'm just lucky to work there. But I wouldn't want the concentrated portfolio on the far right of this spectrum that helps me sleep the best at night, but I have no clarity around what my investment experience is going to be. Because either the money is tied up in the rice farm type experience, or I only own 4 stocks. And stocks go bankrupt, right? You only got to look at whether it's WorldCom or Enron, whatever it might be. Stocks, they go bankrupt, they go down a lot. If you only own 4 of them, or 10 of them, or even 20 or 30 of them, that's a concentrated portfolio. And if one goes away, you can meaningfully affect your investment experience in a negative way. On the far left, in an approach that Dimensional might take, start with the whole world. You know, in a globally diversified portfolio that Dimensional might create and that a client of ours might buy on behalf of their clients if they're an advisor or something like that. You don't start with about 13,000 stocks in 44 countries. So as far as one going bankrupt,
it's just mind-boggling.
You don't miss a beat.
Right.
You wouldn't notice it.
Right.
Right.
Wouldn't even be a blip on the screen.
Exactly. And so for that, to start there and then say, you know, I'd like an environmental overlay. I just really care about the environment. I want to sleep a little bit better at night. What can you do to still kind of maintain that great investment experience I'm seeking through using your funds, but not just being agnostic to the carbon footprint or whatever kind of screen you might ask for from a company. And so for us, as we said, the carbon footprint is the big metric that we score upon. So what we've done is we've created the scoring system, and like we said, we get rid of some of the worst offenders, and then we overweight and underweight. So if a company to begin with was 1% of the portfolio, but they score really well, they might be 1.5%. And a company that's just really bad for the environment, not only in general, but also within their specific sector, they might go from 1% to 0.5%. And turns out that when you start with a super diversified portfolio, like we talked about, 13,000 stocks in 44 countries, if you were to start there, you don't really meaningfully affect the investment experience by just tinkering a little bit in underweighting and overweighting based on an environmental overlay. Now, the biggest tie-in, and then I'll let you kind of take back over, and I think we're probably coming up to a break here pretty soon.
We are.
But the biggest thing I note is to go back to the pricing mechanism, is that I'm not sitting here saying that if you do overweight the ones that do score well, that you're going to be pursuing higher expected returns. I don't know that that's true. But what you can do is on this sliding scale is you can move a little bit to the right towards the sleep better at night, whatever your belief system might be, that you can kind of...
I call it moving the green needle forward.
There, that's and
it does, much more articulate. But, you know, I mean, for me, it is like, I'm not thrilled about what you're saying because it's not enough for me. But I'm one of those people that I am 67 years old and I have to care about what my future looks like. So it's, again, it comes back to, it's really complicated. It's really complicated and we all have to keep educating ourselves and move forward. So everybody, I hope you're hanging on to Ruben's every word like I am. We'll be right back after a short break and talking more with Ruben Miller from Dimensional Fund Advisors. Stay here with me.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening. I'm Gina Murphy, darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Joining me for this hour to talk about the very complicated and impactful world of sustainable investing, and if it's even possible, is Ruben Miller, Regional Director for Dimensional Fund Advisors. Dimensional Fund Advisors is a leading global investment firm that has been translating academic research into practical investment solutions since 1981. The firm has assets of about $600 billion, as Ruben said. And in terms of their commitment to sustainable investing, they believe that sustainable investing is a choice and that investors decide whether aligning their investment decisions with their environmental values is right for them. Dimensional believes that choice should not have to come at the expense of sound investment principles. So, Ruben, thank you so much for being here and sharing, like, this is so complicated. And the thing is, I'm getting it. So that's even scarier. And it begs the question, I don't even think I want to ask this question because of me and my standards and my own practice. I'm in a very fortunate situation because my brother is my financial advisor. So it's 100% complete trust and he has never let me down. And the people that I referred to him he's never let them down either. So that's unusual. Not everybody gets to have that. You know what I mean? So there's trust. But should, and the thought of people managing their own investments, you'd have to be crazy to even go into that foray. Trust me. I mean, I won't even go there. But
we can go there a little bit.
Oh my gosh. We have to go there a little bit. Okay. Because that is like crazy.
I would like to go there for a second because actually one of the biggest misconceptions that I see out there is people think that financial advisors are stock pickers or fund tickers. And that's changed lives.
Not if your brother is one of them.
Yeah, you probably know how he spends his day.
Right.
But a lot of times that term to someone that's not in the industry or not familiar with it, just as a function of that is what it was 40 years ago, 50 years ago. It's changed a lot. And in a lot of ways, just remarkably, it's great for the consumer.
It's changed massively.
And in a great way. So the evolution is what's happened really is there's been a movement away from that expertise, and I use that not entirely seriously, in picking stocks, to being a financial planner. And so I actually really love to talk about my clients as financial planners.
Or wealth managers or
wealth
whatever.
Managers,
there's good, yeah.
They do all these different things from a planning
for
perspective.
Us.
Exactly. And now fees to have an advisor are actually much lower. So a lot of great things. And one of the big reasons why this is, as far as the role of an advisor, is that we've come to accept that markets are really hard to beat. And there's a lot of simple solutions. Like I talked about, there's been this big movement towards passive investing, which is basically, I'm just going to have a super diversified portfolio where I'm not really picking which stocks are going to do better and which stocks. I'm going to pay a low cost. I'm going to control things that I can control. and not pay someone a high fee to pick stocks for me anymore. And so then if you're an advisor that has that approach, you're going to focus on their stuff. You don't spend your day doing research on companies anymore. You do it on the wealth management, helping out with taxes, paying down student loan debt, whatever it might be. And that's really where a lot of the industry has shifted toward, is this more financial planner than stock picker.
So the two questions pop up from there. You know, I know a lot about global warming and about the science. And you talk about evidence-based. And, you know, I had a woman on that I interviewed yesterday, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, and she said that there are 26,900 individual components to the proof of global warming. I mean, that's a big number. They can say, this is why, this is why, this is why. And she's a data cruncher. She was just absolutely a great interview. So it begs the question, knowing what I know, and listening to what you know about, which, you know, is a really good, honest, transparent answer, but not necessarily music to my ears, to eliminate the bad guys and move more for social justice. How many people care? What does your research show? I know I probably don't want to know the answer, because I'm not the perfect example of saying I know where all my money is and it's all in, you know, totally green companies. It's not the truth.
Yeah, so that's another thing where I'm not sure what I say is going to be music to your ears.
That's why I didn't even want to ask it, but we've got to go here.
In my impression, and from what I hear from my clients who are financial advisors, you hear about SRI and ESG and sustainable investing and impact investing a lot. 60 Minutes, whether, you know, maybe you're watching a show that has a segment on it or the news. We do a survey. Dimensional does annually. And one of the questions we ask the advisor community who uses our funds is, how many of your clients have been asking about social responsible investing? And the number is probably much lower than you think it would be. It's below 10%.
I am not surprised. Sad, but I'm not surprised.
Now, as I was talking to you before the show this morning, I can't tell you why that is as far as attributing that to something. But certainly I can imagine a scenario where if you do have an advisor and you meet twice a year for 45 minutes, you have an advisor because you've worked hard your whole life and you're saving for retirement, or you might be in retirement and you want to pay for your kids to go to college and you want to go on the vacations you always dreamed of with your spouse in your golden years and all these great things you've worked your whole life toward. You've entrusted this nest egg with this advisor. In your two meetings of 45 minutes a year, is it possible you forget to ask, oh, are your investments, are you putting
it's
on
true.
My behalf?
It's almost like it's
SRI
in another
funds?
Box, even for someone like me that's a rabid environmentalist. It's in another box. However, when Pathways Financial Partners started sustainableinvestingonline.com and I was approached about it, I switched immediately because of what that meant. And then I told another friend who has their money with Pathways, and she switched. Mm-hmm. And then my daughter started a fund there. She's young, and that's the direction she wants to go. So that gave me, but think about my world
right. And
who I surround myself with.
Yeah. So, and let's go back to, because your question a few minutes ago was about kind of who should have an advisor. Should you have an advisor? Should you do this
Everybody should have. So that's what I think.
So one thing I would say, not that I think you're necessarily wrong, but not everyone can afford an advisor. Now, one cool innovation going on in the advisor community right now is people are finding different ways to charge for being an advisor. The traditional way it was done is the percentage of assets. Well, if you show up to an advisor and you say, oh, I hear that you do SRI investing, I love it, I have $4,000, go to town. Well, 1%, which is kind of a number we all throw out there that's
used
in the community, 1% of 4,000, that's $40.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So I'm not that interested in making 1% on $4,000 if I'm a financial advisor who has all these other things going on. So there's a threshold for a traditionally kind of fee-based advisor in the way things are done. Now, there are, as I said, some innovations about retainer models. There's a lot of advisors doing cool things around. They treat their fee like a gym membership. You pay them some X amount of dollars a month, and they help you not only with the investments, but all the financial planning resources that we talked about. So I would say, actually, an advisor might not be for everyone because there's a fee for it. The greatest thing you can do is, if you need to allocate money, if you need to invest money, right? But you don't have that complicated of a life. Maybe you're not thinking about paying down student loans. You don't own a home. You're not married, your taxes are simple. If your life is just simple, just maybe take a recent college graduate or something. Just know that you should be putting money toward your 401k. If you're young, you should own a lot of stocks in diversified, low-cost portfolios. And the advisory fee might not be worth it because the value of the advisor.
What an honest answer.
Yeah.
I mean, that is such a great and honest answer. And I forget because I'm 67. When we were young and had two kids, we weren't looking for way places to put our money unless it was through our 401k, through our employers. That was it.
Right.
We weren't looking for an investment advisor or wealth manager, but we worked really hard to get to the point where that was an option. So you're so right. And that's not the majority of people.
But yeah, correct. And know that if you are going to do it on your own, there are things that you can control. Right, like fees and diversification.
Right. Do your homework.
So do a little bit of homework. There's a lot of great resources as far as doing that. Now, as far as, you know, who is the right person to have an advisor, the other thing I would say is there are a lot of different types of advisors, right? Not all advisors are going to be created equal either. And there's different investment philosophies, and you might align with one and not with the other. Everything I've described today with Dimensional is I'm saying markets are really hard to beat, and we're not going to try to outguess everybody. And I'm sure there may be some listeners in the Mrs. Green's World community who are like, what are you talking about, Ruben? I know that Amazon is going to go up next year, and I'm going to put a lot of my money in Amazon.
Right.
And that's fine. Like, I'm not here to say don't do what you want to do. You described this in the beginning as an evidence-based approach, and I think that is a phrase we like to use a lot. It turns out, over the long run, people that try to do that, it's very difficult. Typically, you would do it through someone who's doing it on your behalf, and so you pay a fee for it.
Right.
And also, just we're not wired to put money away and avoid the media and not want to trade it and get in and get out. We have fear, regret avoidance. We have all these behavioral, not only behavioral things that get in our way, but we have all these biases and heuristics.
All these conversations going on in our heads about what is the right thing, and then there's what is the right thing for the environment versus what is the right thing for me when I need money for my assisted living in 20 years. You know what I mean? It's all of those conversations.
And to your point, that's what an advisor is so great at. And I love this idea of tuning out the noise. What an advisor does is it's a behavioral coach, right? And it may well be worth the fee if you're the type of person that wants to get in and out of the market, which most people know is a pretty difficult thing to do and still have a good investment experience. So a long story short, as far as having an advisor, recognize that the value of an advisor, especially if it's a traditional fee, let's call it 1%,
is
not just in picking funds for you. It's not what we call asset allocation. Where do I want to allocate your capital? And it may be just traditional funds, it may be SRI funds, but that's not really what the 1% is worth. The 1% comes a lot from the financial planning and all the other elements, a lot of which people don't need if they're young and they don't have a complicated financial life.
Right.
And so I wouldn't purport that everyone needs a financial advisor, but recognize what you're getting from your advisor, and then you can decide if that's kind of worth the fee or not.
And I would say what you said. I would repeat, reiterate, and emphasize that no matter what, start young, because all of a sudden you're in your late 60s. It's like it goes very fast. And if you start young and keep that a piece of your life that doesn't, you know, give you angst, that you know that you're doing something that's growing for your financial stability in the future. I want to ask a question about, in your knowledge base, in your experience, there's so much about the consciousness of the planet. And the majority of people do believe in global warming all around the world, that is evidence-based, fact-based. I can tell you that is true, regardless of what you might hear in the news. And still, less than 3% of scientists disagree with human-caused global warming. I find in my world, going around to places like Green Biz and conferences like Bioneers, and Green Biz is a big, huge conference with major players,
right?
Companies, to me, are starting to care, and I mean all companies, including companies like McDonald's and Amazon, and all the big dogs are at those conferences talking to that population about what they're doing to create a more sustainable and socially just planet. We had Amazon at the last Green Biz conference. I'm sure you know this. One of their biggest issues in terms of any sustainable practices is their packaging. Talk about intensive use of paper and shipping and on and on. And they explained to us, it's not just a flip of a switch. They have suppliers and the supply chain goes down, down, down. So it is complicated. But the question is, do you have a sense that companies in general, even the big dogs, are caring more? And I can use Exxon as an example. They're doing so much R&D to change the world. And I believe that. I'm not, you know, here supporting and singing the praises of Exxon, but they're at a lot of these things trying to learn because it's in their best interests. It impact right. Global warming impacts us all. So there's a selfish and maybe an altruistic or a higher road interest.
Right.
What's your sense of where companies are, or can you even make a generalization?
Yeah. So I would not purport to be an expert in this. I would almost default to you and your community on that. But what I will say is go back to the pricing system. And that is that companies are rewarded when there's positive information about their future outlook. And by rewarded, I mean back to the stock ticker app, right?
Yep.
You open it up, companies that are coming out and doing great things for the environment that have positive news about future outlooks because of it, you can imagine that those prices may tend to move up relative to peers who have poor news about them. Just look at companies that have an oil spill, something like that. Like those things affect immediately the price of
right.
the stock.
Right.
In that sense, the world is changing. And as you said, there's an overwhelming amount of people who feel one way. And that's going to drive consumer sentiment and market participation and the way people want to reallocate their capital. And so, yes, I think that companies certainly are trying to do well by the environment. Now, most people in general are fine or would rather do well for the environment. Even if you might be someone that is on the side of the aisle that is traditionally not associated
right,
with this, I would argue it's not that those people tend to not want to do well for the environment. It's what do I got to pay to do it?
Yeah.
It's all of us, right?
It's not about the money. It's about the money. I say that a lot, it's cliche, but it's also true.
So certainly companies are doing that. And it's not to say, by the way, that by doing that, you can't improve your returns. We talked a little bit about it earlier, but I'm talking about what's difficult is to say everything I know now that's set the current price today, can I now buy it? And then try to create a portfolio of just stocks like that are going to do better than everybody else. What is very possible is that if you own companies and they're making these innovations that aren't necessarily baked into the price yet, and they have positive news that drives stock prices higher, then certainly those could do better than, say, beat the market, as the phrase we're using previously. So it's all about what's publicly available as far as information and just kind of assuming, this is what Dimensional does, that is baked into the price, whether they're good for the environment or bad for the environment, however you might feel about it.
And I just read, this is kind of related, but I read a really long article this morning about what's going on with Nike. And you know, this Me Too movement, it's just like it seems to me that a bomb is dropped a day. Like when Charlie Rose went down, I was like, you got to be kidding me. Not Charlie Rose. But there's been a lot of problems in there. Totally transparent, lots of information out there in the world about Nike. And the good thing about this world and the transparency and the instant news, it's the good thing and the bad thing, is that people know about it and they'll make conscious decisions about how they purchase. And that's the consumer-driven decisions impact it. And for someone like Nike, I think they're stepping up and saying, this is really bad. And lots of the investors, you know, the bad guys have been named and they've quit and they've moved on. But for someone like me, for, you know, women in management and the glass ceiling and all that, it mattered. And I love Nike. Like, I love Nike. So I liked their answer. And I'll make a conscious decision as a consumer. And I think there's a lot more of that where people, you know, slower to judge because there's always more to the story. But what are they going to do about it? Because this stuff happens and it goes on. And how they handle it and navigate it, it'll affect stock prices.
You're right. If you think about just the population, what do we do when we have the chance to vote, right? We get to put our opinion into the market
right.
at the polls.
Right.
When you get to go buy a pair of shoes,
you
get to put your opinion about a company
yep.
if you want into which brand of shoe you buy. And when you go to market, if you choose, you can now, because of, you know, the way that the fund industry has created these SRI funds or wherever, social or whatever it might be that you're interested in, you can now allocate your money there too and invest in only those types of companies in the market. And so there's lots of different ways that people are able to embed their opinion into the ether, whether it's politicians or
And we
products.
Have a lot more power than we think. I think that's the most important message that you give away. This has been absolutely delightful for me. I could go on. We didn't even get to half my questions. So but we covered such important and really fundamental information about where is your money and what impact you can have on it and even what questions to ask. So thank you. Our Down to Earth show on June 28th is with Christine Gina Palsgrove and Todd Hanley. They are a model of sustainability, the case for business recycling, a model partnership. And on the 3rd of July, Dr. Thomas Fleischner, Executive Director of the Natural History Institute. And I think you'll find the show fascinating. Ruben, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
The time flew, so we must have been having fun.
Yeah, great. Thank you again.